My name is Ingrid Kristiansen, and I am a capital mitigation specialist, which means I do the penalty portion of trials where the death penalty is at stake. So a capital case is a case where we're threatening to cut off their heads. It's a case where the death penalty is being asked for by the prosecution. It's a decision that the prosecution can make, except in the federal government, where it's made by our federal Department of Justice. So any given case that comes along is decided by the people who are prosecuting the case. I do individual cases. I get hired by lawyers, and I take a case, and I spend 2 or 3 years working the case up before we're ready to go to trial. Now and then I get hired on a post-conviction case, which is a case where it's already been decided, and then it comes back down through the courts because something wrong happened in the original trial. But most often I do pre-trial, and I learn the story of the defendant's life in a variety of ways, spending a lot of time with the defendant, a lot of time with the defendant's family and friends and pastors and teachers and enemies and anyone who can tell me about the defendant. And then I get all of their records, so their medical records. I hope to get their mom's prenatal record. I get all of their school records and their military records and their incarceration records, and I look physically at the place where they were raised. I learned once, for example, in Jamaica, my client was raised in Jamaica, couldn't figure this guy out, Rayon. He was just the nicest man. He was volunteering, teaching, tutoring, reading in prison, and he was a gentle, soft-spoken, well-educated man. Didn't make sense. Why was there this break in his brain that caused this terrible thing to happen? And I went to visit his grandmother's house in Jamaica, where he'd lived from age 0 to 12, and found that they couldn't grow vegetables in their vegetable garden, and that while I was there, a big water truck came and delivered fresh water. And we were warned against eating any local fish at the local restaurants. And this turned out to be an enormous aluminum plant that was nearby. It was a big scar in the earth. The plant was still puffing away. And the aluminum company delivered fresh water every week to the families within 10-mile radius and gave them compensation for not being able to garden, financial compensation, put a new roof on each of their houses every year because their zinc roofs would rot through with the fallout from the aluminum plant. The bunnies looked unhealthy, but my client would, of course, go out and kill the bunnies and bring them in, and they would cook them and eat them, and they would take the fish out of the sea, and they would, you know. So turned out he had an enormous amount of aluminum deposit in his brain that explained why his brain didn't function well. So I'm kind of a sleuth. I try to find out what happened in this person's pathway on this planet that caused them to come to the place where this terrible thing happened. Some crime for which the state is asking to kill him. The state, each state has their own set of laws about why we want to kill people. They all involve a murder, and they all involve a murder plus some aggravating additional circumstance. So in the state of Illinois, where I'm from, there are 21 aggravators. One is in murder in the process of doing something gang-related. Another is murder in the process of robbing somebody, holding somebody up, or committing a felony, some other felony. Murdering a person past 60, murdering a person under 12, murdering, it's just a sort of a set of everybody's favorite worst thing. And the legislature passes them into law, and then, but every state has its own list, and the feds have their own list. In a few states, you don't have to murder, but sexual assault of a child is a common exception to the murder rule. So every time I get a sexual assault or a sex, a rape case or some kind of a sex case, I know before I've asked the first question, I know that this person was sexually assaulted themselves as a child. I've never failed to find it. You have to look sometimes. There's a lot of denial, but eventually you find it. Anyhow, that's my job, which I just love. People have a hard time believing that, but it's true.
Ingrid, can I ask a question? So your job is not to help prove or disprove the case.
The guilt, no.
But to try to set the stage for whether or not capital punishment should be implemented in this case.
Exactly. And in a capital trial, the actual guilt and innocence portion of the trial is tried. If the jury finds the person guilty, there's often a little tiny mini trial where they decide if this person is truly a candidate for capital punishment. And the answer to that is always yes, because they've sorted that out in advance. And then there's another sort of a medium-sized trial, between a week and 2 weeks, typically, of the penalty phase. And I'm sort of the director behind the scenes of the play that goes on in the courtroom regarding the penalty phase.
Okay. So they've already been convicted.
They've been convicted at that point. And the penalty phase, if say the jury comes back with a guilt decision on a Thursday, the penalty phase would typically start on Monday. So you have to be ready to go. So 2 or 3 years we've spent getting ready for all of this. And then we go right into the penalty phase, because by law, the same jury that hears the guilt and innocence hears the penalty. And the Supreme Court made a decision in 2003 that all defendants have a right for their jury to hear their life story before the jury decides guilt and decides death or life. Most often when it's life, in about 30, I think all the death penalty states, there are 36 death penalty states, the alternative to death, by the time you get to that point, is natural life in prison with no possibility of parole. So, you know, the jury has the two worst penalties we offer here in the United States to consider between every time they make that decision. I'm a Christian, and so I get depressed every Easter season, every Lent, because I just feel this inexorable march of Jesus toward conviction and execution. And I always know, I know now, don't get depressed. We're going to get to the resurrection. You know, I try to keep myself going, but you know, it's sort of what I do, except my clients are not Jesus. My clients, by and large, are guilty. I've had maybe two that I thought were innocent. So I always stew about these questions of the ethics or the morality of the death penalty. The personal thing I hate the most about doing the work is a sense of the machinery of justice. So I don't feel like, I mean, try as we can to be heard about this person being a human person who has a story and an explanation of how it came to be that this person is being executed. I don't feel like that humanity is the main thing at that point. I feel like what's the main thing is this huge steamroller of justice sort of moving ahead and flattening everything in its path. So, and it doesn't always mean that we lose. I mean, I've actually got 24 wins and one loss on my record. Mm-hmm. But it's a kind of a helpless feeling to know the steamroller is coming. So I'm not a theologian, and I don't know theology. I mean, I come to Holden Village a lot and go to Bible class. I'm a regular attender at church. I go to Bible study. I read my Bible. But I am not a theologian, and there probably are some here in the room. There are probably also people in this room who have been the victims of crimes or whose families have been the victims of crimes. There are murder victims everywhere, murder victims' families everywhere. And also, you may know someone who's been wrongfully convicted. So we need to be real respectful of each other's points of view. And it's one of the wonderful things about Holden Village is that this kind of a setting, we can all bring our best thinking and ethics, morality, our best thoughts about a difficult societal issue together in a place where it's safe and where we can freely talk about what has our faith got to do with all of this. I was trying to think about how I know the things I know to be either wrong or right. And I think some of the ways I know, one of them is practicing my faith. You know, I learn through experience. How helpful is it when I lose my temper and yell at someone and catastrophize and call them horrible names? Well, it's not the most effective, usually, way to get through whatever the crisis is or the situation is. But how do I feel when I get to be on the serving side of the silver counter? You know, how do I feel when I help somebody who's helpless walking down the street or anywhere? Or how do I, you know, so I learn, I feel better about my humanity when I'm a decent person. And you all have experiences of practicing your faith and how, I mean, after my mother died, for example, I was a total basket case because the person who loved me the most on the planet had died. And I was very aware of the prayers of my Christian community buoying me up, holding me up. So that's another part of my practicing of my faith. It was just an unexpected gift of God. So I think we all learn things through practicing our faith. And we learn things by reading the Bible, and we learn things by, I think in this case, Jesus has a lot to teach us, because Jesus embodies the death penalty. He broke the laws of society. He was condemned. He went through a period of, he was tried and convicted, and then he was executed. And he didn't go through it alone. He was on death row with two other guys, one on each side. And one of them, who was a different kind of criminal, I don't know exactly what he did, but something, said to Jesus, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And that person said, and Jesus said, "Today you will be with me in paradise." So I just think that story about Jesus forgiving someone, whatever his sins have been, and saying, "You're going to be executed here, but you're not lost," is an embodiment of something about the death penalty. And we can talk about what we get out of that. So there are a lot of places. If we think part of practicing our faith is mercy, forgiveness, and unconditional love for one another, for the Christian community, for the global community, for whoever, there are a lot of places where the Bible speaks to this. And because I read the Bible with my clients a lot, and before that I spent 15 years working with prostitutes, so I read the Bible with prostitutes a lot. And when you read the Bible, Bob Ekblad, Pastor Bob Ekblad, who serves in Washington State with a lot of farm workers, but he does prison ministries. He's written a wonderful book called Reading the Bible with the Damned. Mm-hmm. And it's a privilege to do. If you ever have an opportunity to read the Bible study Bible stories with people who are real marginalized in our society, you get into their heads, and the Bible sounds different. It's a different experience, which I find very helpful. I'm going to read you a few bits out of Romans 12 and 13. In 12, I'm going to start at 9. Let love be genuine. Hate what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. So listen to these words with the death penalty in mind. Love one another with mutual affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not lag in zeal. Be ardent in spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in suffering. Persevere in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints. Extend hospitality to strangers. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. And it goes on like that. And then do not repay anyone evil for evil, but take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Never avenge yourselves, but leave room for the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. No, if your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they are thirsty, give them something to drink, for by doing this you will heap burning coals on their heads. That doesn't sound very nice.
Ulterior motives.
Yeah. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And then we go on to chapter 13. Now, this is important. What is the difference between our personal efficacy as an ethical person? For example, if I get attacked by a bad person, and the bad person is going to rape me or murder me or do something, or if my children, or children I'm responsible for, how do I can I personally kill that person by accident? Of course, I'm not witty enough to know how to kill them with my bare hands, but suppose I were. Some people are. Or I could push them off a bridge, or, you know, I could do it somehow. Would that be a good idea? So my personal action to, say, save myself, compared to our corporate responsibility, what do we ask our government to do in our name? So what authority is vested in the government, and is that different from the authority vested in individuals? And here he says some stuff about the government. Let every person be subject to the government. This is Paul. I think it's Paul. I mean, I never know which is claimed to be Paul and been Paul. But let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Well, no, we'd have a tough time with that, policy-wise, in this country, wouldn't we? Therefore, whoever resists authority resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. So do you wish to have no fear of the authority? Then do what is good, and you'll receive approval. And then later on in chapter 13, he says this. No one anything except to one another. Follow the commandments. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not murder. You shall not steal and not covet. So there is, I mean, a lot of people who favor the death penalty argue we have vested in our government the authority to kill. And it's in the Old Testament all over the place. You know, those who live by the sword die by the sword. And the Old Testament says, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That's in Exodus. I think that was from people who know about such things tell us that that was designed to limit the amount of retribution or response you could have to the violence of another. So if somebody poked out your eye, you weren't to kill them, or you weren't to, you know, I don't know, poke out their eye and their ear, but you were to just limit yourself to an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I hear repeatedly from people who do Bible study on that subject. And then, of course, Jesus says in the New Testament, you have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, turn the other cheek, love one another, you know, care for your enemies. That's in Matthew 5. So Jesus sort of refutes that whole eye for an eye business. Although juries still regularly cite it as the reason why they give the death penalty. The case I lost, the jury cited that and said, well, it was our faith that caused us to give the death penalty. It was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. They were all either Catholic or Lutheran. So, and then the other, before I throw this open for conversation, I want to say that there's a sense of, there's the problem of deserving. What do we deserve? If we are bad, what do we deserve? And if someone's really bad and murders people and does horrible things and maybe tortures them, what do they deserve? And of course, the ultimate is, what does Hitler deserve? And should we conspire together to kill a Hitler among us? So, I have one. What do you think? What do you think about that deserving question? What do people deserve for who do bad things, including murder?
Well, it's like a case-by-case basis, I think. Because like you said, there's extenuating circumstances, not just the event of what their crime was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what common sense, if practicing our faith and common sense have something to do with each other. You know, you'd say, well, common sense kind of dictates this. We don't, in this country, for example, execute people any longer, theoretically, who are retarded, because we think they don't have enough sense to make good decisions. Now, in actual practice, we still do that, because the judge will rule against bringing it in as an argument, or, you know, it fails regularly as a path.
If people are under the influence of drug addiction, does that ever factor in?
Mm-hmm. A lot.
So does it, are they more condemned because they're, you know, the stigma of addiction, or are they?
Or are we progressive? Is that
like
people
insanity?
Who see addiction as an illness, it's no different from a broken arm. It's what we in the biz call a two-edged sword. Because you can make the argument, you know, under the influence of drugs or alcohol, and an addict, and an addiction is an illness, and then people say, yeah, but he was using drugs. So,
yeah,
you have to kind of make a judgment call. It goes both ways at trial.
I guess at a minimal level, people who commit a capital crime deserve to be isolated from the rest of us if they're still a threat. You know,
mm-hmm.
So people, another way of defining deserve is that we deserve to live in safety,
yes,
and harmony, and that's,
yes,
God's intention for us. So,
yeah,
what is the most appropriate way at a minimal level to isolate people who, you know, who continue to be a threat, and that doesn't get into vengeance or retribution and all that. And you mentioned you look at prenatal, and I heard watched some testimony on the, you know, public channel about fetal alcohol syndrome and impulse control.
Mm-hmm.
And a medical professional made the comment that if you want to find these people as adults, around 60% of them are incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my gosh. You know, and some of those people, just the impulse control, they've murdered people.
Mm-hmm.
And if their brain isn't wired right, you know, I don't necessarily want them out,
mm-hmm.
or they could do it again if there's a biological reason,
mm-hmm.
for their behavior.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really good. And there's this whole part of our brain right here, which is called the executive function of your brain. And if this has been damaged, which, you know, think of all the baseball bats that hit all the... But it's certainly affected by various chemicals, including prenatal stuff. Then I have a client right now with this problem, and he's a nice guy. I mean, he's sort of soft-edged, and he's not smart. He's just on the borderline. He's tested under 70, and he's tested over 70. And we're not so far succeeding in getting the court to accept him as retarded. But he robbed a convenience store. He went into a convenience store. He got the money. There was a woman behind the counter. There was a video going. He had on a baseball cap, so his face isn't entirely visible. He robbed the woman behind the counter. She was a Latino. He's black. He was in a Latino neighborhood, which meant, of course, that every young man in the whole neighborhood knew he was there, looked at him carefully, watched what he did. He goes into the convenience store, he robs her, and then he brings her in the back room to try to get the tape out of the video. And he gets upset, and his judgment goes kaflooey because she's threatening to him, and he's losing control, and so he shoots her. And, you know, she was a lovely young mother of several children, and then he came out, and by then, an old grandfather had wandered into the store to get a loaf of bread, and he shot him. But he was just all, like, his adrenaline was going, and this was not going how he had planned, and it was he was worried, and it was a mistake, and he was just, and so he did these things.
Like in the fight or flight.
Fight or flight, yeah. And in jail now, he's just been a placid kind of a, you know, for 3 years, he's pretty much, but a few times there's been a fight on the deck where he is, or some big kerfuffle, and he's gotten engaged because his adrenaline starts to go, and then he just, and we tell him over and over again, your record here is going to determine so much about what happens to you at trial. Mm-hmm. And he understands, yeah, I know, I'm really trying, I'm going to be. And then his adrenaline starts going, and he does something crazy again. You know, he gets involved in prison. So he doesn't appear to have very much control, and he certainly knows it's against his own best interest to do that, to get in fights in prison. So there's that Ezekiel passage, which says, I mean, I have all this... these conflicts about what it means to fix people who are broken. There's a whole argument, there's a whole school of thought that says we should not execute people until they have become saved.
Until they become what?
Saved. Religiously.
Oh.
And it's a parallel because it says so in the Bible. So... Ezekiel, let's see, I think it says it in Ezekiel 33:14-16, let me see. And it's other places too. Again I say to the wicked, you shall surely die. Yet if they turn from their sin and do what is lawful and right, if the wicked restore the pledge, give back what they have taken by robbery, and walk in the statutes of life, committing no iniquity, then they shall surely live, they shall not die. None of the sins that they have committed shall be remembered against them. They have done what is lawful and right, they shall surely live. So, you know, in my work, we don't like to bring in the religious faith of our people and the religious activities in prison. I have people who study the Bible every day, who lead Bible studies on the deck, who attend every opportunity to go to a worship service. They sing in the choir, they dance in the praise dancers. Mm-hmm. But we are reluctant to bring that in. Why do you think? At trial. Because a jailhouse conversion, oh yeah, right, jailhouse conversion, they know how to save their life, you know, but there are people who argue we shouldn't execute people until we've really tried to save them because maybe they'll get saved. And as long as they're alive, it's possible they'll be saved. And therefore, the Bible asks us not to execute. What do you think about that argument?
Well, I think it's related to redemption.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think if you have faith in redemption, either like spiritually or just socially,
mm-hmm.
that one act doesn't mark your entire existence,
mm-hmm.
That then you don't, it's not right to execute someone because you've then removed possibility of redemption.
Yes, that's true.
And I don't know if that's exactly the same as saving someone, but it's that people can do good with their lives.
Yes.
And it's not, I mean, I guess you know where I'm coming from. I don't think it's society's place to make a determination that actually you can't. You can maybe segregate someone and protect society.
Right.
Yeah.
And we can. We can actually... there are supermax prisons all over the place where people live in stainless steel, you know, 6x9 cells for the rest of their lives. And they, some of them, some places like in the federal supermax in Florence, Colorado, they can't even see another human being with any regularity. I went to interview somebody there and a couple years ago, and he hadn't seen the face of another person for 4.5 months when I got there. And, you know, they actually understand in Florence, Colorado, it's where Massawi is, and, you know, all the sort of high-profile federal people who didn't get the death penalty. Tim McVeigh's partner, Terry Nichols,
mm-hmm.
The crazy hippie who had all those women following him around who killed all those people.
Charles Manson.
Yeah, Charles Manson. Anyhow, they understand at Florence how crazy this makes human beings. So I need a whole day with him, even though if he'd been a normal person, I would have needed 2 hours with him. And they gave me a whole day because it took him, I would say, 2 hours just to get into the space with me. I mean, he just poured out what his brain had been thinking about for 4.5 months. And I just listened to all this stuff about his case before he even asked me why I was there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was just... And they acknowledge that it makes people crazy to live like that. But we can... And in Illinois, we have TAMS, which, you know, as they say, makes grown men cry because it's isolated. They slide the food through a slot in the door. You get out 1 hour a day by law, but... The hour could be at 3 a.m. or whatever, and no one else gets out at the same time as you, so you're completely isolated. I really wish that every congregation would adopt one prisoner with a long-term record, a long-term sentence, or a life sentence. It would just be transformative. I just really wish that. But we have a rule that we can't execute people who don't know why they're being executed. So we don't execute people who are schizophrenic until they have taken their meds long enough to be in their, quote, right minds. And then once they're in their right minds, we can execute them. So schizophrenics who have a right to refuse this medication are in the bind of either having to be in their own personal nightmare of insanity, or they have to become sane so that they can be executed. And I sort of feel like the same, and it's also true, we treat people on death row with cancer and heart disease and stuff. We try, really pour a lot of money into them to try to keep them healthy and alive until we can execute them. We prevent suicides. And if someone tries to commit suicide, which they regularly do, we pour every effort into restoring their life. So We don't want it to be a voluntary execution. We don't want it to be a suicide. And we don't want it to be a state-sponsored euthanasia. So there is some, I mean, what's the difference between the death penalty and euthanasia, do you think? It's just the will of the person who's being executed. The will of the person says, I want to be alive. And in euthanasia, they say, I want to be dead. Have a good dish, team.
Thanks.
Sometimes the people actually do want to die, though. Does that factor in?
It does factor in. I would say 100% of my clients have gone through periods of really wanting to die. And I have to really be able to talk to them about why they should live, why it isn't a good idea for them to volunteer. We call them volunteers in the business. And the state does not want to be complicit in that. So the state doesn't want to partner with them in executing them or in euthanizing them.
So but if they are looking at a future of a really grim holding tank sort of space, mm-hmm. how do you motivate them to not want to end that future?
Well, I have a few arguments. One is I tell them that there's a lot of people in line behind them. And if there's any kind of legal hoeing we can do in the row, the legal row that this one is in, that will help someone behind him, he should be willing to hang in there and fight. He should be willing to let us do everything we can do legally to try to save him, and then a little more of the row will be hoed to save the next person. That doesn't always work because they don't always feel that they should care about the next person. I talk to them about their behavior in prison, and I just say, if you are well behaved and mind your P's and Q's, you won't be in total isolation. You will be given some latitude, and you will earn latitude. So then I spend a lot of time working with my clients on their gifts and their the good they can do with their lives, and who they can correspond with, and who they can help in prison, if they can teach someone to read, or if they can help be a good, sometimes they're a good listener, and I say, you could be a good listener to a lot of people who need someone to listen to them in here. And, you know, or they can, I mean, they can do any number of things if they are willing to stay out of trouble enough so that they get some movement. And that works for a lot of people. Mostly they've never been told they have any gifts. Never. So they have no sense of their own giftedness. Because most, they're all poor. They've all been to bad schools. They've all been kicked out of school. We don't execute middle-class people in this country. We only do poor people. So they have lived the life of poverty and paid that price from the beginning. And so there isn't a lot of emphasis on gifts, on children's gifts, growing up in a poor community, on the gifts of an adult who's been pushed out of school when they were 13 or 14, on the gifts of someone who's found a way to get by in life by selling drugs or something like that. But I'd spent a huge amount of time with them, and we talk about, I mean, they're sober in prison, for one thing. And so we can talk about real issues. And we do Bible study if they're Christian. I mean, I tell each of them that I will accompany them at the end. I'll be present at their execution if we lose every step of the way and during the appeals. And they want me there. Because I know the story of their life better than anyone. And I know the path that led this way. And I know why they had the break that led to the murders. And they deserve a sympathetic interpretation of their life story, to be present there, respectful, just respectful. And so I say, I can't accompany you into that space without knowing what you think is happening there when you die. And I want to know what your faith journey is, what your spiritual journey is. So I read the Quran with them, or I read the Bible with them, or I talk about spirituality, and I talk about love and grace and forgiveness. And I had a client once who really wouldn't. He was being offered a plea. He could get, I've forgotten, 40 years or something, if he would plead to a crime. This was a crime that happened where he killed some members of his girlfriend's family and her new boyfriend. And he ran away covered in blood. He killed with a knife. He ran away covered in blood. The cops come. Half an hour later, he walks back up to the house and sticks out his hands and says, "I'm the guy you're looking for." And he's covered in the blood of his victims. And he confesses. But he will not confess 3 years later before trial, to save us going to trial and save us risking his life in the death penalty. He won't say he did it. And I kept saying, "You've already said you did it. Why don't you accept this plea so you don't risk losing your life?" And it finally came out that the reason he couldn't say he did it is because he was ashamed before God, and he felt that he had done such a terrible thing that God could never forgive him, and he was lost. And as long as he couldn't confess to God, he couldn't confess in court. Well, we started off on the shepherd with 100 sheep, one of whom was missing. And we talked about the missing sheep and who the shepherd went after, not the 99, but the one. And there are lots of stories like that. And then we talked about the vineyard where the workers, I mean, this was over months, this didn't all happen one day. And every day I would pray, every time we read these stories. His grandma had raised him in the church. And the vineyard where the workers came in at 5 in the morning and 7 and at noon, and then some came straggling in at 5 in the afternoon and worked an hour. And I said, "So what do they get paid?" And he'd look it up, you know, look there. I taught him to read. He couldn't read, but by now he could read. And we were studying, I make Xerox copies of these stories because you're not allowed to bring books in. And he looks and he struggles through it and he says, "A full measure of pay." And I said, "What does that mean, a full measure of pay?" And he said, "It means that the ones that came at the end got everything, the same as the others." And I said, "Dad, who are you in this story?" You know, and he figured out that he had come at the end. And then we were sitting at a steel table with a glass, thick glass wall in front of us. And we were two bolted down stools side by side. And there was a guard just on the other side of the glass, making sure that I wasn't, whatever, doing something bad. Slipping him a knife, or, I don't know, giving him a blowjob, I don't know what.
Isn't it also for your safety?
I suppose.
But they also think that you're somehow going to, I don't know.
Well, they search me before
be complicit
I go in.
And
so
something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right. Anyhow, it's just routine. You just get watched and hurt. You know, they're not allowed to listen to you, but they can watch you. So anyhow, I grab his hand right down here, and I just prayed, and it really wasn't something I'd thought about, but I prayed for the Holy Spirit to blow through that place and clean a mind and make him open to believing in the forgiveness of God. And damn it if it didn't work. He was a changed person. And he took the plea, he went off to prison, and he writes me every Christmas. I send all my clients a Christmas present every year, books or coloring books. They love coloring books or something. And it worked out. And it was a miracle. I mean, it truly was a miracle. But it's so hard for them to understand that God does forgive them.
Uh-huh. And it strikes me as you're talking about all this that the where you point to in the Bible are stories.
Yes.
You know, whereas the sort of pro-capital punishment parts of the Bible are more these categorical statements, uh-huh. almost, right, about an eye for an eye, that are read that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure where I'm going with that, but it's just, you know, I mean, it's like, yeah, so the story of Jesus is the story of someone who's executed,
mm-hmm.
right, convicted and executed.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how the story gets, you know, when it gets stated, right?
Mm-hmm.
It gets theologized.
Mm-hmm.
And abstracted,
mm-hmm.
and then it's not like tied to. I don't know. It's just like it's a hard. It seems like it's a harder case to make with stories. I guess I'm trying to think sort of culturally, like why if that story at the center of our culture's religion
mm-hmm.
is the story of someone who's
and the center of our religion is the three guys on the cross.
Yeah. Why does that story not?
Persuasive.
Yeah.
Let me tell you what I think about that story. And I could be wrong theologically, but I find it to be so clear that Jesus, what do we learn in Canarin? Jesus died for our sins. And Jesus, so the whole, there's a lot of history. I mean, we used to kill people, to execute people in the early years of the United States because we didn't have jails. So in the old West, the Wild West, you know, bad guy, too much trouble, shoot him.
Or hang on the gallows.
Or hang him, yeah.
Yeah.
Make him an example. And then there's a whole sense that evil in a community needs to be weeded out and gotten rid of. So a bad person in the community, and you still hear that in some communities. I was in South Africa studying violence, and we were in a community where there was a person who was molesting children, and they killed him. They didn't take him to the courts. They didn't make it public. They just said, this is a bad guy. We're getting rid of him. And then they said the community then had responsibility to raise his children and pay for his, you know, support his wife, because they had taken these things from that family. They realized they had to supporting their family. But this whole business of sort of expiation and having our sins be that we have to pay for our sins. We have to. There's a price, and so we have to somehow expiate our sins. But what I hear Jesus saying is that has been done for us, and the reason that he did it was for us. And it wasn't supposed to stop on the 21st of March in the year 2072. You know, it doesn't run out. It doesn't have a limit. It's unlimited, and he doesn't say it's only for some people. It's only for he who's without sin. You know, so I just feel like, okay, we were supposed to, there was something about that, but it's not there anymore. Jesus did this thing so that central image in our faith could be the image of forgiveness and expiation and being made right with God. And I think we still hang on to that image as a culture, that we still think something has to be done here to make it right, to get this festering ugliness out of us as a people and make us right again. Does that seem like it might make sense to you at all? Do you hear any language like that when it's talked about? Or?
And that executing people makes it right?
Well, that would
be the
implication,
yeah. I'm still waiting for the person that says they really have had closure,
yeah.
You know, and have let go.
Well, one of the arguments for execution is that it gives closure to the victim's family. And there are a lot of studies being done on that, and it does for some people.
Mm-hmm.
one of the biggest study that I know of being done on it is the Oklahoma City bombing, which was, I think, 460 victims. And Terry Nichols and Tim McVeigh were the two perps. One of them has been executed. And when you're executed in a big case like that, there's some, you get a lot of media attention. There's a lot of it, you know, everybody knows your name. So Tim McVeigh is a lot harder to remember because he's just locked up and thrown away the key. Terry Nichols was executed. But
it was the other way around.
McVeigh
was executed, Nichols.
Right. So Nichols is locked up. The families in that case started out at the end of the first year. A guy named Bud Walsh was the father of a 26-year-old girl who was killed in that bombing. And he started organizing the parents, the families of the victims. And at that early on, there was a lot of revenge talk and saying, you know, that they had to pay for this sin by dying. So it was, I don't know, 75% of the families wanted them to be executed. And then every year that went by, that number has dropped. Until now, it's really small. And nobody wants the remaining one, Terry Nichols, to be executed. Because they found that when McVeigh was executed, it didn't help. Mm-hmm. They didn't feel better. Mm-hmm. And they said, we thought it would help. Mm-hmm. And it's such a bad feeling to be told over and over again by the prosecution, this is going to help. This is going to give you closure. First of all, they're not told that it's going to take, on average, 11 and a half years. So if your mental health, restoration of mental health after losing someone to murder, is dependent on the court system, and you know, if you have to wait and unexpectedly you'll turn on the evening news and there'll be the case again. Your daughter's photograph will be on the news. Or it'll be, you know, there'll be an appeal or another appeal or this or that. Some things keep happening on these cases. And it makes the families crazy. And they don't get closure. And because they've been told over and over again, you're going to feel closure when this is over. It's a mean lie to tell them. But state's attorneys don't want families to say publicly, we don't want the legacy of our loved one's murder to be some other family's loss. We want the person to be locked up, but we don't want them executed. We don't want an execution because of us. And so a lot of, and murder victims' families have a variety of other things they sometimes need. If the defendant is a psychopath and wants to be interviewed by the news all the time and is constantly trying to become famous, they might want that to just stop. And so I know of a case where they made a deal with the defendant and his lawyers that they would take the death penalty off the table if the guy would stop giving news interviews and never give another one. And he agreed, and that was the end of it. So he just sank into oblivion. Another case, the murder victim was carjacked, a woman. Her two children were in the back seat, young children. And the grandmother who was raising the kids wanted, she said, I wake up in the middle of the night all the time with questions. I want to know the look on her face. I want to know what she said. What was the last thing she said? I want to know what the kid... So they made a deal with the prosecution, with the guy, the defendant, and his lawyers, the defense, that lifelong, as long as a man lives, they would be able to go to whatever prison, any member of their family could go to the prison where he was being kept. And with the help of a psychologist or a social worker, they could ask him any question they wanted, and he had to answer. And so that door didn't slam shut, and they felt they had. They said, we never go. We don't go anymore. The mother talked to him once. But she said, I just needed that. And I needed those kids in case they have any memories of this. What do they want to know? Why did you kill my mother? You know. So it leaves that door open. So that's what that family needed. They didn't need the death penalty. In fact, the death penalty would have been the opposite of what they needed. So if, I mean, in our court system, it's oppositional. We're supposed to hate each other and fight, and we're not supposed to talk, the two sides. But if, I've been trained as a victim outreach person, so I've sort of thought a lot about how to break that barrier down. If a person can bridge the two sides and help the victim's family thereby, and bring some kind of healing into it, and some different values than just the value of revenge, it does an enormous amount more good. And the healing of that family is dignified and taken away from the dependence on vengeance.
Is part of your process with the victim, or I mean the perpetrator, helping him take a responsibility?
Yes, I work.
Because it seems like so many people just want to hear something contrite, you know.
Mm-hmm. And this kid whose hand I finally grabbed and begged the Holy Spirit to come to that place, he finally was able to write a letter to the family and express his deep regret, which he truly felt. And it was healing.
And tell the truth.
Yeah, tell the truth.
Yeah.
Not everyone can get there, but I really work on it. And when they do get there, it is so much better for the defendant. They then can move ahead.
I remember years ago, there was an organization or something where you could sign a form or a letter or something saying that if you were ever murdered, that you would request that capital punishment not be sought for the person, you know, who did that. Do you know if
I've never heard of that?
And I don't know. I was going to ask you if you know if that has any effect anyhow, because the victim doesn't decide who's charged, right? In a criminal case, it's the state. And so, like when you were talking about what the victims needed in these instances. Will the prosecutor take their point of view into consideration, or is that individual depending on the prosecutor?
It's individual depending on the prosecutor, but there's also the power of the media.
Sure.
So it's sometimes the media, if these stories are told to the media, it helps. Because then people go, well, then why are we doing this?
Right.
And one other argument that you should be aware of is the cost.
Yeah.
The cost is at least a minimum of 3 times as much for every time we ask for the death penalty, whether or not we get it, as a people. Like right now, there are 140 people in Illinois where we're asking for the death penalty. Each one of those cases is going to cost between $1 and $5 million. If we just locked an 18-year-old up and threw away the key for the balance of his life, it would cost us as a people $600,000 on average. So it is so much more expensive to get the death penalty. And so then all the ethical issues, like end-of-life issues in the medical profession, you know, should we spend 70% of our healthcare dollars on people who are in their last 6 months of life, or should we try to do prenatal care for poor women, and, you know, all the things you can do. But the same thing is true about the death penalty. Shouldn't we try to take some of that money and deflect it into prevention? And wouldn't that make for a healthier society? We incarcerate so many more people than any other country on the planet. So are we out of time? Did that bell mean that it was over?
It's 3 to 12.
Okay. So any last questions? I'm sorry not to have the answers. But I've sort of shared with you what I'm thinking about and what my mind goes to.
Is there something that states are rethinking the death penalty now? What, 10, 15 years ago, we wanted to put everybody in prison and do the death penalty. And I'm just wondering if the pendulum is swinging back so that there are more people that are opposed to it than there were 10 years ago.
Well, it's still 63% of the people that favor it. But New Mexico just got rid of it for financial reasons. Georgia had to stop a case recently because of financial reasons. They just ran out of money. The case ground to a halt. Nobody would work for free, so. I've been let go off of two cases recently because the state ran out of money and they couldn't pay me to continue my work. There's more and more talk in state legislatures about how much it costs to do it. So, you know, they have to set aside millions of dollars. But on the other hand, in Illinois recently, the state I know the best, all the social service agencies that serve teenagers have lost about a half of their funding. Some of them have been entirely lost their funding. And in this year's budget, we just increased money for the death penalty by $1 million. So it's not universally common.
Does Illinois still have a moratorium on executions?
We're not executing people, but we're filling death row up as fast as we can.
So still prosecuting capital cases,
yes,
but not actually.
Yeah.
Huh.
So we have 14 people on death row right now, and 140 waiting to be tried.
California has a couple things going on. They have something called the Commission for Fair Administration of Justice, which looked at all the components of the justice system, but they had a special focused chapter on the death penalty. And they documented those costs, and the consensus that people for and against the death penalty was that California, to do it right, had to spend twice as much as we were spending now. And we're also building a new death row. I think the capital cost is around $400 million. So there's that going on that's really put a lot of foundation under arguments about the cost. And then because we had there was a court case saying lethal injection process was unconstitutional, there's a long administrative rulemaking and regulation development on the lethal injection protocol.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't really been involved in that. But there were arguments made, well, Native Americans aren't getting the sweat lodge, you know, which they believe they need before they're executed. It was just all those issues about,
mm-hmm,
you know, the end of life decisions,
mm-hmm,
and respecting,
mm-hmm,
religious practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, because I did a tour of death row 4 years ago that was really an inside tour. You know, the whole thing is just a ritual killing.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
it's just, it really emphasized the illegitimacy of it for me. So, but in the meantime, we're spending huge amounts of money to do it right and have the process be appropriate.
Yeah, the killing, the lethal injection involves three drugs. The first one is supposed to paralyze the person so that they appear to be relaxed. And it frequently doesn't work so that they are clearly not relaxed and they're not unconscious. And then the next drug is something, I've forgotten all three, you know, the protocol, but it's so unsuccessful because it's not administered by medical personnel because it's against the rules for you to, it's against first do no harm, you know, the Hippocratic Oath. So there can be no doctors involved, supposedly, though of course there are some. But it is a set of drugs that the national veterinary people have declared to be illegal. So it's too painful, the set of drugs we use is too horrible and painful to kill dogs and cats with, and that vets will not use it. But it's what we choose for people.
Was it instituted to be humane, more
yeah,
humane than
yeah,
other methods?
Somebody just
isn't?
Made it up, sort of whole cloth, somewhere. And
that's so strange.
And it's story after story. I mean, I told some stories on Monday about it. One guy was, this year, was in the middle of the process, and they couldn't find a vein, and they were doing it wrong, and the drug wasn't working. And finally, he'd been there so long, he had to get up and use the bathroom. And another guy, and frequently, I mean, I've got lists of stories here where people say, I'll help you find a vein. You know, they're drug addicts. They know how to find veins. And so, you know, it'll go on for 20 or 30 minutes, people poking at them, and then finally they say, well, let me do it, for Pete's sake. And so then they're released from their bonds. They put their own, you know, now what is the line between suicide and euthanasia and execution?
Yeah.
So story after story of people who do their own injections. And they they lift their heads up and say things like, it isn't working, you're not doing it right. It's, I mean, it's just, the stories are just legion of failed processes. They go on for hours sometimes.
Do you, are there studies or concern about the correctional officers, either who work on death row or who are involved in executions? Because
yeah.
That's got to be a psychological...
Well, and it's a volunteer position. So any correction officer who is a high school graduate can volunteer to be the executioner. And
you know, in the old days, you would always hear about a firing squad, that they'd all, a bunch of people would have guns and one would have a bullet. Do they do anything with the death squad so that a person doesn't know if they're the one?
Yeah.
I don't know.
They
how
have
do you do
three
that
guys,
one?
And they normally have long tubes, which, of course, get clogged and they get folded and bent so the drugs don't go through them, or the wrong drug goes through first or something. And then they're off in a different room, and there's three guys, and they each have chemicals, and they each are or something, and they each release them, and they don't know which one is the lethal. And they do the wrong dose, and they, you know, I mean, it's a complicated thing. They're given a powder, and they're supposed to mix it a certain way, and they fail to mix it the right way. And so people have, like, 12-inch burns up their arms because they couldn't, because it was put in the wrong. And I mean, it's just barbaric. It's just willfully barbaric. And the Supreme Court just recently, like 3 months ago, reaffirmed that it's the way to do it. It's legal.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It's just barbaric.
A requirement before confirmation of a Supreme Court justice that they have to witness.
Witness one.
Execution.
I mean, I suppose some of them go well, but I hear the stories of the ones that don't, and they really are horrendous.
Do you ever cite or have a handout on a reading list you recommend?
I like online. There's the National Death Penalty Information Center. And they have, I mean, they've got all kinds of readings, including wonderful readings on what every faith group talks about with the death penalty. And so there's that one, the National Death Penalty Information Center. And then there's one. The other good one is called CapDefNet, Capital Defense Network. And both of them are just rich sources of information. So I really recommend, if you want to do reading, those are, you know, thousands of articles on all different subjects.
It might be good to mention, you know, the ELCA is working on a criminal justice social statement process that's just getting underway, and there's a task force. I haven't even seen a list of the group, but for those that want to make the case that we have, the church already has a death penalty social statement, but for those that want to make the case that we can do things better in the whole system and stop short of the death penalty as well, that's a good process to be involved in.
And the ELCA social statement on the death penalty is a good one. You can just go online at the ELCA and print it out, or you can write to them at the Division for Church and Society at the ELCA, and they will send you a copy. I was chair of that board when it was written, and I was quite happy with it. So thank you for your interest and time.